Right. So yesterday, I defined a topological field theory in terms of a functor from a geometric category to a linear category. And basically what we did was we classified, well, one way of saying what we did yesterday was we classified brains in less than one dimension. Okay, when space-time is a discrete set of points, we found all possible d-brains, and they were classified by k-theory. And so today, I'm going to describe some variations on that theme. So this is really a continuation of what I was doing yesterday. And I should have said that lectures 1 and 2 are based on work with Graham Segal. So for some of you, it'll be quite obvious, the influence of Graham. What I'm going to do then is say a few general words about generalizing the two-dimensional topological field theory structure, and then I'm going to focus on one particular generalization, namely what happens with orbifolds and what are the sowing conditions and so on that one wants for orbifolds. And that breaks up into 3 subsections. It's already not totally trivial to say what's going on taking orbifolds of topological field theories in the closed string case. And this leads to a structure which I'll describe called Taraev algebras. Then I'll introduce the open and closed strings. And there's going to be a category of boundary conditions. And I'm going to argue that it's twisted equivariant k-theory. Not a big surprise, but again, the purpose here is having a baby example. It's supposed to be pedagogical and easy. Well, that's why I'm doing it. The final section is a second variation. As I stressed in yesterday's lecture, there's a very big difference between the case where the Frobenius algebra, the closed string Frobenius algebra, is semi-simple and non-semi-simple. And as I said yesterday, the semi-simple case, I think of having a space-time, and I think of it as a baby model of string field theory. The non-semi-simple case is what's relevant to brains in Calabi-Yau manifolds, for example. And here, it's still an interesting question, given a C, what are the possible O's? And I'll say a few very brief and naive words about that problem. A few words on some generalizations. We know that there are all sorts of string theories. There's string theories with space-time supersymmetry. There's space-time without space-time supersymmetry, with world sheet supersymmetries. All sorts of different string theories. And you can, as far as I know, you can axiomatize all of the different flavors of string theory by changing the geometric category. So somebody asked yesterday about non-oriented surfaces, and you can certainly generalize that. You can replace the oriented cobordism category by the unoriented cobordism category. And what changes there? Well, essentially not much, as far as I understand it. What happens is you have to introduce the crosscap, that is, RP2 minus a disk. Now, that has a single circle as its boundary. And that circle, RP2 minus a disk, you can consider that circle to be an ingoing boundary or an outgoing boundary. And if it's an ingoing boundary, then you're defining some new kind of trace. And if it's an outgoing boundary, you're defining some new kind of state. And here's a picture of that new state, the crosscap state. And the only new point is that the crosscap state has to satisfy this equation, where delta is the handle-adding operator. That's a version of the familiar fact in the classification of surfaces that 3 crosscaps can be replaced by a single crosscap and a handle. And in the context of topological field theory, this was addressed by Horjava. And I'm not sure that the full structure of the open and closed unoriented theory has been worked out. I've been talking to Ilka Brunner about that. Another example are what you might call spin theories. This is a way of axiomatizing n equals 1 supersymmetry on the world sheet. Here what you do is you use the category of oriented cobordisms with spin structure. You can also model n equals 2 theories. Here you would take oriented surfaces with a complex line bundle. And now a nice point is that a complex line bundle has a natural integer associated with it, its first turn class. And that integer is related to the kind of gratings, I think, that Paul was talking about. Another generalization is to consider orbifolds and make things G-equivariant. And this is the generalization I want to focus on today. Okay. So let's suppose, so I want to describe taking an orbifold of a two-dimensional topological field theory, because I want to understand what sewing means, what sewing constraints impose on orbifold theories. Now, supposing a two-dimensional topological field theory has a group of symmetries. That is, we have this commutative associate of Frobenius algebra, and we have a group G of automorphisms of that Frobenius algebra. We'd like to gauge that symmetry to form the orbifold. Now, gauging a symmetry means coupling to external gauge fields and then summing over them. Okay? So in our context, G is a discrete group. And so gauging the symmetry is just summing over G bundles. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to define a G equivariant theory. That's the coupling to the external gauge fields, if you like. That'll be most of the work, and then we'll project onto the G-invariant sector. Okay, so what do we do? Well, we replace the oriented cobordism category by the category whose objects are, in general, D minus 1 manifolds with a principal G-bundle over them, and the morphisms are cobordisms with a G-bundle over it. Now, let's consider the two-dimensional case. So what are the objects in our geometric category? Well, the basic thing to focus on is the case of a single circle. And here, for every group element little g, you can form a bundle over the circle, a g bundle over the circle, by regarding the circle as an interval 0 to 2 pi with a trivial g bundle over it and attaching it via the map g. So this has this bundle has holonomy g. And now, please pay attention. This is the group element is labeling the object and not the conjugacy class. And that's important. Okay, now, what was S? I was just being sloppy preparing the transparencies. For a single circle, you form this bundle over the circle. I don't understand the question, maybe. I'm just describing the basic object, and then I'll take disjoint unions of these.
But the equivalence classes are still labeled by conjugacy classes.
No. The objects are bundles, not isomorphism classes of bundles.
They're isomorphic in the category.
Sorry?
They're isomorphic in the category.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, when we have circles, there are lots of
but
circles, but there's only one circle up to 50 orbits. Maybe orientation preserved.
Yeah.
Similarly, if we have circles.
You're trying to push me into two categories, and I'm going to steadfastly refuse. you could talk about morphisms between the objects, and then you have another kind of morphism, which is the surface. And my category number, Dan, is less than 2. So, so
mine is negative.
So I'm going to be a really naive guy, indeed, in this talk. For me, you know, a G bundle on a circle is described this way. You have a circle. You choose a base point. Choose a base point with a green dot. OK? and you have a group element associated to the loop, any line that begins and ends on a green dot. I knew that people would get confused about this, but I think that this is a good way of just very hands-on way of thinking about it. Here's my object, P sub G, and it's going to map to a vector space, which I'll call C sub G, and of course that's the G-th twisted sector. Now, there is another way of looking at this, which some people might find helpful and some people might find totally opaque. If you're in the latter class, just ignore it, but some people might like this. So what you can do is you can think of the objects as a pair of a circle with its base point and a base point preserving map into BG with its base point. And you are identifying maps up to homotopy, such maps up to homotopy. And you can do that with a flat connection over the space of maps, and I don't want to go into all that. But this is another way that's sometimes helpful to think about it. In this way, you might describe this as strings moving in the space BG. Okay, so I hope I haven't been incredibly precise, but I hope it's clear what I'm trying to do. And of course, the morphisms, the surfaces connecting these objects are surfaces with a G-bundle on them. So the question arises, what's the analog of the sewing constraints from yesterday? Okay. And this was analyzed in a recent paper, maybe 2 years ago, by Taraev. And he proves two theorems, and the first part of the talk is going to be explaining his two theorems. So the first theorem is the sewing constraints in the G-equivariant case. And the sewing conditions are summarized by putting an algebraic structure on the total space where I sum over all the twisted sectors. Let's call that curly C. And the structure I'll call a Taraev algebra. And so this is a theorem and a definition, if you like, to give a two-dimensional G-equivariant topological field theory is to give, first of all, a G-graded algebra. That means there's a multiplication respecting the twisting sector. A group homomorphism from G into the automorphisms of C, which acts on the twisted sectors in this way. So if H is in G, then I have an automorphism alpha sub H of C, and it acts on the twisted sector by taking this one to that one. There's a G-invariant trace from the untwisted sector to the ground field, so that the corresponding quadratic form is non-degenerate. The restriction of alpha sub H to C sub H is the identity if phi lives in the same C sub H. And now we do not have a commutative algebra anymore, even though we're talking about closed strings. It's not commutative. But it is twisted commutative. And what that means is this equation here. If I have phi prime in the sector twisted by H, and I act with alpha H on phi can be in any CG, then this product is this product. So it's sort of got a kind of commutativity condition. And then there's a complicated torus condition, which is best explained with a picture. So for the moment, let's just say there's a condition that involves a trace on different, a relation between traces on different twisted sectors. And it will be manifest when I write down the picture later. So that's Taraev's theorem. Now I better, well, first I'll make some remarks, and then I'm going to write some pictures that explain where all this stuff comes from. Okay, the first remark is that C sub 1 is an ordinary, good old garden variety commutative Frobenius algebra. The only thing about it is that G acts on it as a group of symmetries. As I've just stressed, it's non-commutative. The total space C is non-commutative. And in contrast to the previous case, there's now a genus 1 constraint. Now, Taraev Of course, Taraev didn't call this a Taraev algebra. Right? Taraev called this a G crossed Frobenius algebra, which is incredibly misleading terminology, and it tripped me up for months because he called it a G crossed Frobenius algebra, and I'll explain why that's bad terminology. So I'm going to call it a Taraev algebra. So now let's see where some of these pictures come from. Okay. Now, first of all, where's the product and where's the automorphism? Well, imagine my sinking feeling this morning when I realized that some of my conventions were backwards. I think I got it right here, but there's no guarantee. Okay, so how do we define the product? Well, we want to take the product from twisted sector G2 times G1 to twisted sector G2, G1. So to define such a product, we have to write down a surface with a G-bundle on it. Now, I just told you that what we have to do is we have to specify the holonomies between the green dots. And it suffices to specify that on a system of curves such that the complement is simply connected. Okay? So here we have... If we didn't have the equivariant theory, you would just say, here's two incoming circles with states phi1 and phi2, and there's one outgoing circle with the product state. But now we're in the equivariant theory, so this guy has holonomy G1 around this circle, this guy has holonomy G2 around this circle, and I define the product by declaring the product to be the surface where the holonomy is 1 on these two cuts. You can define your own product by putting other holonomies on it, and it will be simply related to my product in a way I'll describe. But I'm going to define it this way. So that's why I made the remark about the maps to BG. Okay? So think of these things as mapping to BG, and so the green dots are going to the same point in BG. So we're talking about the homotopy class of that map into BG. And you know that every G bundle is obtained by pullback from BG. So that's one of the reasons I find that formulation quite clear, because I get confused about that question.
We could also think of your category as the category of bundles over surfaces, circles, where you have a base point on each boundary, and the bundle in the middle has a base point over the base point in the base.
Say that again, sorry.
An object in your category is a bundle over the surface together with a base point, one base point on each boundary component.
Right.
So then when you have the path, you can lift it. And since we have the base points, we can...
Ah, good, thank you. That's a very clear way of saying it. Yeah, thank you.
Not EPG.
Sorry?
Okay.
Okay, I agree with both of those statements. Okay, so now you see, what's the holonomy around the outgoing circle? Well, you can compute it, because you go here, you get G2, G1, and so on. So the outgoing state is in CG2, G1, and this is the, by definition, the product is this way now, phi2, phi1. Now, what about the automorphism? Well, the automorphism is defined. Remember, before we had the cylinder, and I said without loss of generality, the cylinder was just one. Now we have many cylinders. So here's a picture of a cylinder, but I have to choose the holonomy from the ingoing to the outgoing base point. So if I choose holonomy H, then you see the outgoing state is in twisted sector H, G, H inverse. So that defines the action of the automorphism. Okay? Okay, so now let's look at these conditions here. So one condition was that we have a group homomorphism. Well, that's kind of obvious. You just compose two cylinders. It's also easy to check. It's also easy to check that alpha is an automorphism of the algebra. And now what about this weird constraint that alpha of h of phi is phi when phi is in the twisted sector C sub h? So here's a remnant of this morning's debacle. Here, focus on this picture. Here, we have phi. It's in twisted sector C sub h. And here, we have the automorphism alpha sub h on phi. Now, you consider now a Dane twist. And that will take this curve to this curve. So the holonomy around here is h, but the holonomy around here is h. So the holonomy here is 1. Okay, but that's my ordinary untwisted cylinder, so that's just phi. So that's why alpha h on phi is phi. I hope that's clear. What about twisted commutativity? It's the same kind of thing. here, I have a product of the automorphism alpha acting on phi 1, then times phi 2 in that order. Okay, and now I can bring this guy around, so I get the holonomy G2 around here, but I had holonomy G2 around here, so it's 1. Now I have my ordinary definition of my product with 1 and 1 here, so that's, but I had to change the orders, so it's phi 2, phi 1. So that's twisted commutativity. Okay, and finally, the torus condition, which I promised would be less obscure if I drew a picture, is here. So what we're doing is we're looking at a torus. What we're doing here is we're looking on at a torus where around the A cycles and the B cycles we have holonomies H and G inverse. Okay? And the torus has a hole, which therefore has holonomy HG, H inverse, G inverse here. And I'll call the state I insert on that hole psi. Now, you can look at this in the usual way. You can look at one of these as space and the other as time. And if you do that, then you've got two different operators on the twisted sector. So so in one case, you'll have the automorphism alpha g composed with left multiplication by psi. You see, alpha g takes ch to cghg inverse, and left multiplication by psi takes you back to ch. So you can take a trace of that operator. And similarly, you could take a trace of the operator the other way around. And so that gives you the torus condition. So unlike the non-equivariant case, in the closed strings, already for closed strings, you now have non-commutativity, and you have a non-trivial torus condition. OK. And so that's the sort of the basic elements that go into Taraev's first theorem. Okay, that this is the structure of, well, he proves then that this is all you get. With what? You mean, Yeah. I haven't thought about that. Okay, so that's theorem one. Okay, now proceeding in complete analogy to yesterday, what would we next want to do? Well, we want to know what is this set of examples of such Taraev algebras. What do they look like? And here again, there's a good analogy to yesterday's discussion. When the algebra is semi-simple, there's a good answer. There's a space-time and a B-field. So how does that work? Well, first of all, what does semi-simple mean? By semi-simple, I mean the untwisted sector is semi-simple. And so Taraev's second theorem says that there is a 1-1 correspondence between semi-simple Taraev algebras and triples, x, b, and theta, where x is a finite g-space. That just means a space with a g-action on it. B is an equivariant cohomology class with, well, I should have said k-star coefficients over the ground field. And theta is a g-invariant function to k-star. So I'll denote the Taraev algebra associated to these data by T of x, b, theta. Now, what I'm going to do is explain why this is true. I'm going to give, in fact, a new proof of his result. And so there's a 1-1 correspondence, so we have to go both ways. So let's start first by supposing that we're given a g-space x and a cocycle, a cohomology class. How do we produce a Taraev algebra out of that? How do we produce a Taraev algebra out of a space-time with an equivariant cohomology class? Okay. Now, to do that, I'm going to do three easy constructions in category theory. Okay, and they're really easy, actually. So, remark one. In general, if a group acts on a space X, then you can form a category, which I'll call X slash slash G. Okay, and what are the objects? The objects are the points in X. And what are the morphisms? Well, the set of morphisms from a point X0 to a point X1 is the set of group elements that take X0 to X1. So a morphism is simply an arrow, just as it always is in category theory. So here's a picture of a morphism. It's from X0 to X1, and it's the G, and this we have such a picture if G dot X0 is X1. Clear enough. Okay. Second construction. In general, if we've got a category, we can always form a topological space called the space of the category, which I'll denote absolute value of C. And how do you make that space? Well, the vertices correspond to the objects. The edges are the morphisms. Now, if you have two morphisms, like this one and this one, which compose to a third morphism, you fill it in. That's a face. If you have a bunch of morphisms that are all coherent in a way that makes that diagram commute, then you fill it in with a tetrahedron. And on you go. Okay? And so you get a topological space. Let's apply that to this very straightforward category where we have a G action on a space X. Well, what are the P simplexes? The P simplexes are a point X and some tuple of group elements. And some of you will recognize that if X is just a point, then I'm simply describing a group. Okay? And in fact, the resulting topological space is the classifying space BG. So it's infinite dimensional. For example, BZ2 is infinite real projective space. And if you generalize this to a set X with a G action, you simply get the space X times EG over G. Now, the definition of G equivariant cohomology of a space X, the definition of this object here, is certainly just the good old cohomology of that infinite dimensional space.
Yeah. So if you apply this construction to this category, you're going to get
That's what I'm saying. So this X here is a model for this space.
So applying this, so when you apply this construction to this category, you get EG.
You mean X times EG? I don't think so. I think I get. I think they're non-trivial loops, for example. I think pi 1 of this space is clearly G.
If I look at
Now, let's just focus on pi 1. Sorry?
If you take g slash slash g,
yeah.
You get eg. That's the standard.
Thank you, Ezra. Right. Yeah, just apply it to a point. I think you'll apply it to a point and think about what is pi 1 of this space. Okay? So, if we apply it to a point, we just have a loop for every group element. I don't see how to contract that loop. If I have two loops, I can, you know, move them. But, where was I? Okay. That's the definition of equivariant cohomology. Many of you have probably seen definitions in which people write out these functions satisfying these incredibly complicated relations. And what those relations are just the co-cycle conditions for a co-chain on this complex. Okay. Third and last category construction is if you've got a category, any category, then you can form an algebra over a field K as follows. You, as a vector space, you sum over all of the morphisms of the category with a line for each morphism. Okay? Now we have to define an algebra structure. So let's choose a generator for each line, L sub F. And then the product of LF2 and LF1 is zero if the morphisms don't compose, and is, well, it's clearly proportional to LF3 if the morphisms do compose. But then I have to choose some element of K. I'll choose it in K star so my product isn't stupidly zero. And what do I want? I want an associative algebra. So a nice fact is that the associativity condition here of this algebra is the same as saying that this B is a two co-cycle on the space. You see, what am I doing? Whenever these three morphisms compose, I have a two simplex. What does it mean to give a two co-chain? It means to give a number for every two simplex. So that's what B is doing. When is it a two co-cycle? If and only if your algebra is associative. Okay. So what's the upshot? Okay? The upshot is that if we've got a G space X and a cocycle B, then we can make an algebra, and here it is very explicitly. Every time we see this diagram here, we get a line. So let's choose a generator, epsilon GX, for that line. When we see this kind of diagram, we can multiply these epsilons, and so the explicit formula is here. For product of two epsilons in terms of a third with some factor B here. And now, a good point of view to take is that since we're working with a finite G space, we might as well just decompose it into orbits and assume that G is a homogeneous space, G mod H. Okay, in this case, we can identify this here actually with an ordinary group cohomology class on H, the stabilizer of a point. Well, what have I done? I remember I'm proving Turiaf's theorem, which says that a semi-simple Turiaf algebra is in 1-1 correspondence with a space with a two co-cycle. And now what I've done is I've explained to you that given a G space and a two co-cycle, I can produce an algebra. Now, it's actually not Turiaf's algebra. So first, but it's closely related. So first, I'm going to explain to you what that algebra is conceptually, and then I'll explain where Turiaf's algebra comes from. Because I want to make a point in a moment. Now, this algebra that I've described is essentially what's called a crossed product algebra. And again, quite generally, if group G acts on a space X, then it acts on the functions on X in the obvious way. So with this action, the delta function at X moves to the delta function at G dot X. And when you have this situation, you can define what's called a twisted cross-product algebra, C of X, semi-direct G. What it is the algebra of functions of g into c of x, more generally into another algebra A, with a twisted convolution product. So here's the definition of the twisted convolution product. This stands for the function which takes g1 to function f1 on x. So the idea here is that you want to move the g2 past it to the g1. But in doing so, it conjugates f1. So that's the action of the automorphism. And then the g's multiply with this 2 cocycle. Now, when you formulate D-brains on orbifolds, or when you try and formulate solitons in non-commutative field theories, you always run into the cross-product algebra. Okay, there have been several papers over the past year about that kind of story. And if you look at all the literature on D-brains on orbifolds, you always find the cross-product algebra there. Okay, and so it's a very natural object. And moreover, if my B cocycle is not only a random element of H of X, but for every orbit is coming from a 2 cocycle on G, then this algebra I've described for you is exactly the twisted cross-product algebra of C of X with G. And the big shock was, for me, that this does not satisfy the sewing conditions. Twisted commutativity fails. That's why I call it a Taraev algebra and not a G cross Frobenius algebra. It's not a cross product algebra. But can we recover from this disaster? Yes. We can recover because there's a sub algebra which does satisfy the sewing constraints, which is what I call the algebra of little loops. So remember that Taraev algebra had arrows for every G connecting 2 points. Now what we do is we consider the subalgebra that looks like this. We only, with any point, we only keep the group elements that fix that point. So they're little loops at that point. Okay, so that's a picture of the Taraev algebra. And in formulas, the twisted sector, C sub G, is the sum over space-time points of the g's that fix that point and the line, the same line I described before. Now you can go and formulate all that data that I needed before. It's rather straightforward. The trace on a little loop is 0 unless the loop is associated with g equals 1. Then theta of x is a g-invariant function on x. Twisted commutativity tells us what the automorphism has to be on the algebra. And it's not surprisingly conjugation by epsilon of hx. And if you work that out, you find the ratio of these cocycles. Notice that the product of elements here is hg in both cases. Okay, and so that's the first half of Taraev's theorem. Given a g space and a 2 cocycle, I have produced for you a Taraev algebra. Now, before I go on to prove the converse statement, let me make a few remarks, 2 remarks, about this algebra of little loops. First of all, we are going to project onto the G-invariant theory. That's the orbifold theory. So we're going to have to sum over these automorphisms here. Now, it's curious to see this ratio of 2 cocycles, and people who've worked on discrete torsion and orbifolds recognize that right away. Notice that if g and h commute as they would on the torus, then you have b of hg over b of gh. And so this really corresponds to the discrete torsion weighting in topological sectors. And therefore, I'm going to henceforward refer to b as the b field. Okay. The second remark I find kind of intriguing is that how should we think of this space-time with these different points? Well, I claim that they should be thought of as disconnected components. So even though I could form the cross-product algebra with the group elements, the arrows that take that are associated with group elements going between these different blue dots, I decline to do so. I cannot include those in a way that respects the sewing conditions. And that means that the sewing conditions which formalize world sheet locality actually are also formalizing, actually have as a consequence a very crude form of space-time locality. So that's how I think of the failure of the cross-product algebra to satisfy the sewing conditions. Okay, so it remains to complete the proof. Yeah, sure. When I project onto the G-invariant theory, I'm basically going to be taking a sum of delta functions over these various points with different phases. That's a nice point. But I think the point is that I'm imposing sewing conditions on the G-equivariant theory. Yeah, so there's something to understand a little better there.
I thought the theorem was that every brave algebra was going to be equivalent to three pieces of data.
Yeah.
And I thought actually it'd be two pieces.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The trace is a little bit trivial. It's just associate a non-zero number to every orbit, which I call theta c. And so I'm very sloppy. Sometimes I don't include it. It's just a G-invariant function on k star. And if I had been more careful, I should have included it. To me, the really non-trivial thing is the B field, and that's why I focus on it. But you're right. Yeah?
I'm sorry. This sort of came up in your own way. Why, before you do the orbital projection, right, why should
because when I couple, well, the way I think about it is when I couple to the G fields, I still want to sum over surfaces. I mean, you could say that all we care about in the end is the orbifold theory and who cares where it came from. And I don't think I can argue with that. I'm simply saying if the theory came from projecting onto an invariant sector of some theory, which is a sum over surfaces, coupled to gauge fields, then this is how it has to work. And I can't rule out some more exotic possibility. Okay, so let's finish the proof of Turiya's second theorem. Well, I said there was a one-to-one correspondence, so let's go the other way. Suppose that C is a semi-simple Turiya's algebra. Well, then C1 is semi-simple, so we have the Gelfand story. C1 gives us our space-time. Now, G acts on C1 as a group of automorphisms, so automatically this X is a G-space. What about the twisted sectors? Well, these are finitely generated projective modules over C1, so we learned yesterday that those are the cross-sections of a bundle over X. And now I'm going to compute that bundle. To do that, I'll take the basic idempotents of C1, the delta functions at X, and I'll multiply C sub G by epsilon 1 X. OK, that tells me what the fiber is at X. And now a nice application of the torus axiom is that using that, you can compute the dimension of this fiber by taking h equals 1 and this psi from before equals epsilon 1 x, and it exchanges a trace in the sector G to a trace in the untwisted sector, and the result is that this fiber dimension is 1 if x is a fixed point of G and 0 if not, but that's precisely the algebra of little loops. Remember, we have one generator every time we have a little loop fixing a point x. So that derives it. Okay, so that's a proof. And that completes the closed case. So are there any questions before I go on to the open case?
So we think of this data that's missing as a sort of exponentiated Dilithium field?
Yes, absolutely. The theta, the normalization of theta is the closed string coupling, as I explained yesterday. Okay. What about the open and closed case? Well, now as before, we introduce an open string sector with open string algebra O and theta sub O. And here the analog of the sewing conditions is given here, that what we have is we have in the closed string sector, we have a Taraev algebra. Then we have O and its trace, and it has to be a representation of G. So there's a homomorphism from G into automorphisms of O, preserving the trace. And yesterday we had an important map, which was the closed to open string transition. Now we have a closed to open string transition for each twisted sector. And they satisfy three conditions, which generalize straightforwardly yesterday's conditions. So remember, iota lower star was a homomorphism into the center. So now it's a G twisted homomorphism in this sense, that if I take iota G1 and iota G2, the holonomies compose. Instead of centrality, we now have G twisted centrality, which means that we can commute iota G of phi past a psi if we act with G on the psi. And then we have G twisted Cardy conditions, because for each of these, we can define iota upper G by the adjoint condition. And then there's a canonical map pi I'll write on the next slide, and it must factorize through the closed string channel. Now, it would be definitely too tedious to prove everything there with give you all the pictures, but let me at least indicate the basic data. Okay, so here we have our open string sector. It's the incoming red arrow, and it has a green dot. Now, of course, there's no twisted sectors for open strings because they're open. But nevertheless, if you have a map between open strings, you can have a G action. So there's still a holonomy from this green dot to this green dot, and that means there's a G action on the open string space. The closed to open transition is indicated here, and I'll take it by definition to have holonomy 1 here. And then the open to closed transition has by definition 1 here. You can put other holonomies here, but of course that's just pre or post composing with either rho or the automorphism alpha. So there's no essential generalization by doing that. And then the G twisted Cardy condition is written here. On the closed string side, we could put holonomy G around here. So this is clearly the composition of open, closed, closed to open. And here, that deforms to this. That gives me a map which I call pi G, which is just like the map from yesterday, except that G acts in the middle. Okay. Now, as with yesterday's discussion, your question then becomes, what are the solutions of the sewing conditions? And again, when C is semi-simple, we can determine the possible boundary conditions, and once again, they have a geometrical interpretation. So, for simplicity, let's take, no pun intended, let's take x equals g mod h. Okay, so we'll take a single orbit, and supposing we have a Taraev algebra, T of x, b, and theta. So we have a space, and a B field, and a trace. Then the most general solution, O, of the sewing constraints is given by a projective representation, V of h, with the same cocycle as in the closed string sector, and a choice of root. Okay, I'm not going to prove that. there any questions about the statement? So how do we prove that? Well, we have the untwisted sector and its Cardy condition. So by the ordinary Cardy condition, we know we have a bundle of matrix algebras, full matrix algebras over each space-time point. Okay, so we can write O sub x, the fiber of O over the space-time point x is endomorphisms of E sub x, or just a full matrix algebra for some bundle E on x. That was yesterday's talk. Now, the complication comes when we think about how G acts. So G acts compatibly on O and on X, but all we can conclude, as I'll explain more in more detail in a moment, all we can conclude is that G acts on the projectivization of this bundle E. And that is that E is a BO twisted vector bundle for some cocycle BO, B sub O for open. I'll explain what this terminology means. Since I haven't defined it yet, I will rephrase this step two right now in more concrete terms. So step two is equivalent to step two prime, which goes like this. We have a G action on this bundle of algebras. So rho of G takes O at X to O at GX. So now think about what happens with the stabilizer of X. Well, the stabilizer of X acts as a group of automorphisms on this full matrix algebra. But all automorphisms of a matrix algebra are inner. So it follows that the action of rho is just conjugation by some matrix, rho sub V of H. Now I know that these rho sub Vs compose as in a representation up to a scalar factor. A scalar factor would, of course, cancel out here. So I know that rho sub V of H is a projective representation for some cocycle. Okay, now, to go further, let's simply study what's going on at the identity coset, because G equivariance will then just push the same thing around all the way around the orbit. Okay, so we had two conditions from before. We had the homomorphism condition, and we had the centrality condition, which I've now written this way. So the homomorphism condition says that H goes to iota H of epsilon H is a projective representation of H for the closed string cocycle. Centrality says that these matrices here commute with all matrices psi. Now, anything that commutes with all matrices is, of course, a multiple of the identity matrix. So that means that this matrix and this matrix, that this matrix is proportional to this matrix by some function of H. And that means that the cocycles are equivalent cocycles. So without loss of generality, we can take them to be equal. That's the end of the hard steps. The rest is now completely determined. You know what iota lower G is. You compute iota upper G, you discover the Cardy condition is satisfied if the square of the open string coupling is the closed string coupling. Okay, let me give an example of that. That completes the proof of the theorem. So supposing that so perhaps it's more useful to put back the theorem to say what. Okay, supposing that H is Zn cross Zn, and G is one more factor with H embedded in the first two factors. So here's what the space-time looks like. And the second cohomology of Zn times Zn with un coefficients is also Zn. And it's generated by the cocycle, which I've written here. So omega is a primitive nth root of unity. Beta 1 of omega to the I, omega to the j is omega to the ij. That's a non-trivial cocycle. And the only irreducible representation with that cocycle is our friend, the discrete Heisenberg representation with the usual n by n clock and shift operators that satisfy that. So what would it mean to choose a B field with B equals beta 1 at this space-time point? It would mean that you can't have arbitrary matrix algebras. You must have matrix algebras which are endomorphisms of some number of copies of Cn for capital N. In other words, your vector space at that point has to have a dimension which is a multiple of capital N. Okay, so that's how it would change things. Okay, so now we're at the point where we were at yesterday when I said, here's the general solution of the open string sewing conditions. And I got, yesterday I got a bundle over space-time, and today I get something like a bundle over space-time, but a choice of a projective representation of H. And it remains to interpret properly what are the solutions of the open string sewing conditions. So, what's our answer so far? Our answer is that if X is a homogeneous space, then the objects, if you'll allow me to take inverses, I agree that was an awkward step yesterday, but if I do take inverses, then the objects are the representation ring of H with twisting B. Now let me say a few words about K-theory. First, about equivariant K-theory. Well, the equivariant K-theory, the G-equivariant K-theory of G mod H, is the representation ring of H. And that's actually fairly evident. If you start with your bundle at the identity coset, then if it's G-equivariant, you can simply just push it over the rest of the orbit. Okay, so the precise connection is obtained by thinking about V, which is a representation of H, giving you an associated bundle, G cross sub H V over G mod H. What is this? This is the set of pairs G and V, which are identified with GH inverse and rho of HV. So now let's extend this to twisted bundles. Now I told you I would define what a twisted bundle is, and here it is. To define a B-twisted bundle, I'll take a projective representation of H with cocycle B. And I'll try and do the same thing. Let's try and make an associated bundle with fiber B. Well, now you see we're going to get into trouble, right? Because G comma V is, by this equivalence relation here, is on the one hand, it's equivalent to this expression where I've simply made the equivalence relation twice with H1 and then with H2. On the other hand, it's also equal to this, but these two are equal. So these two had better be equal, unless my vector space is non-zero, or I'll basically prove the fiber is zero. But if there's actually, if this is actually a projective representation, I'm dead. So this doesn't make sense if B is non-zero. Nevertheless, by exactly this argument, it's quite clear that the bundle of projective spaces makes sense. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about twisted K-theory. And it's also clear that the bundle of matrix algebras on V makes sense, because in the matrix algebra, the phase cancels out under the G action. You have G inverse matrix G. Okay. So we have a well-defined bundle of matrix algebras, and indeed, that's what we got from our theorem. Okay. Now, if you've got a bundle of matrix algebras, you can consider its cross-sections. And the cross-sections of a bundle of algebras is another algebra. And you can take the K-theory of that algebra. And that defines twisted K-theory. Okay, so in this case, the twisted K-theory would be K-naught of that algebra. Now, if I choose equivalent cocycles, B and B prime, then the K-theories are the same. In fact, it only depends on the class, the corresponding class in H3 of X, so people usually denote it as K sub H of X. So let's combine the twisted notion with the equivariant notion. The twisted equivariant K-theory of X is just the B-twisted representation ring of H. And so the theorem is that the category of boundary conditions for a semi-simple Taraev algebra with a space-time x and a B field B is the B twisted G equivariant K theory. Pardon? Whoops. Well, did I make a mistake here? Oh, no. You see, here, I think I know what you're saying. Here, you want H to be H3 sub G.
Yeah.
Well, here I'm trying to do one step at a time. Oh. So I'm first doing the equivariant. Okay. Then I'm telling you what the twisted K theory is. And the twisted K theory is K sub H. And now I'm combining the two notions, and you're absolutely right that in the twisted equivariant K theory, the H would be an H3 lower G. Okay. Now that determines, okay, so now now we're completely done with the equivariant theory. And now it remains to project onto the invariant theory, the orbifold theory. So let's do that. Now, unfortunately, I found a bug, which I didn't have time to fix. So so I'm going to have to put B equals 1 for the next two transparencies. And I believe that what I'm going to say extends to B not 1, but there was a mistake in the way I proved it. OK, so let's take the orbifold theory. Well, what we want to do is we want to take that Taraev algebra and project onto the G invariants. And the way you do that is you simply average over the automorphism alpha sub H. And what that comes down to is seeing what the average does at the identity coset. And the average is written out right here. It's a sum over these twisted sector type type phases and a sum over H modulo, the centralizer of H. So the upshot is that the invariant, that the orbifold algebra has a dimension which is the number of conjugacy classes of H. On the other hand, we can consider the boundary states O, and if we project onto the invariant boundary states, well, we can work out all the formulas from before, and we get a sum of very similar terms here, but what comes up is the character of this projective representation V. So the boundary states form a lattice in the invariant space, okay, a lattice of boundary states which with one basis vector for each B-twisted irreducible representation. And so, unfortunately, I have to put B equals 1, which is not the most interesting case, but when B is 1, the orbifold theory, the invariant Taraev algebra, is the H-twist, is the G-equivariant K theory of X. Okay, now let me make a few remarks about this. First, this might remind you of some work from 10 years ago by Dykra, Vafa, Verlinda, and Verlinda, where they studied conformal field theory of orbifolds with a single chiral algebra, a chiral algebra with a single representation. And they found this mysterious result that the Verlinda algebra was the same thing as this Lustig algebra of G equivariant bundles on G. And this is actually an example of our result. Here, the space X is G, with G acting on itself by conjugation. That breaks up into a disjoint union of orbits corresponding to the different conjugacy classes. And for each orbit, we're in the previous situation, we had an orbit, and we get a set of boundary states which are labeled by representations of the centralizer of G. The second remark is that in the literature on D-brains on orbifolds, these various irreps correspond to the fractional brains. And the third remark is that I think of this as sort of a baby example of the theorem of Fried, Hopkins, and Telemann, identifying the Verlinda algebra with twisted equivariant K theory. All Okay, that completes the section on the first variation on the G equivariant case. Well, my remarks on the non-semi-simple case are brief. How do people feel? Want a break for lunch? I'm happy to, go do the last five transparencies. Okay, I'll do it. I get the sense that people are really tired. It's been a long morning. And, it's not clear that this is the kind of thing that should be explained in public, but I did want to. did think that it might be interesting to some people. I'm referring to the stuff about orbifolds. I think people will find this interesting, especially since it ties into a lot of the things that Paul was saying this morning. So it's related to what Paul said, and it's interesting. The relations might be interesting to explore. Okay, so let's do quickly the non-semi-simple case. So, of course, many examples of Frobenius algebras are not semi-simple, as I mentioned last time. And I don't think it's useful to view this C as functions on space-time in that case. A good example is already to take this Frobenius algebra, the quantum cohomology, the classical cohomology of CPN. It has one primitive idempotent, one space-time point, no interest in K-theory, and yet there's obviously a lot of interesting structure there. So still, it's interesting to ask, especially in the context of A models and B models, given a C, what are the possible O's? Okay? Because if you think of a topological field theory, if you just forget about the Lagrangian where it came from, if you say a topological field theory is this structure, you know, if I'm giving you the A model or B model closed string topological field theory, you might ask, what is the set of all possible O's that I can associate to that? Now, I will describe some solutions and some examples, by no means a classification. But I think they're illuminating solutions. So here's a typical example of a non-semisimple Frobenius algebra. I mentioned it yesterday. It's the cohomology of a compact-oriented manifold. Okay, so here's C. It's a graded commutative of Frobenius algebra, and the trace is just the integral. Okay, so what's an O that satisfies the sowing conditions? Now, my knee-jerk reaction to that was, well, you obviously just tensor over the matrices, right? Just put a vector bundle over. And that's wrong. Okay, let me explain why that's wrong. You see, if you just take O to be C, tensor the n by n matrices, or matrices, n by n matrices over C, then you can define a Frobenius algebra structure. Theta sub O of psi is the trace of psi and integrated. No problem with that. The problem is in the Cardy condition. Okay? So let's think about the Cardy condition, because if you have an open and a closed topological field theory, they don't just live in isolation. They are connected by homomorphism, right? And that homomorphism must satisfy the Cardy condition. And that's an extra and important piece of data. So let's consider the map pi that I mentioned before for the open algebra. So what do? You choose a basis. You choose a basis for your algebra. So here I've chosen a basis omega lower I for the cohomology. It has a dual basis of forms, omega upper j. So that's the dual basis condition. These are matrices, so I introduce matrix units, ELM, okay, and the dual matrix unit is EML. Okay, and now I sum over the omega I's and over L and M. That's the map pi, and I hope I got my signs right. It's quite a nightmare. But I think these are the signs. Anyway, what is this going to do? Well, think about first the sum over L and M. What that's clearly doing is taking the trace on psi. Now, what about the omega I wedge, psi wedge, omega upper I? Well, what you see here is the Euler character of, basically the Euler character of the tan of X, thought of as a top degree class, right? Because omega lower I wedge omega upper I has to be a top degree form. So pi of psi, at least when X is even dimensional, to get rid of these signs, pi of psi is the Euler character of X times the trace of psi tensor 1. Okay. On the other hand, what is the homomorphism? Well, the only obvious homomorphism around is to take phi to phi tensor the unit matrix. Now, if you do that and you compute iota upper star, iota lower star, you get this result, trace of psi times 1. So these just aren't equal. Okay, but now, so the Cardi condition fails. So this is the answer to Tony's question yesterday and Ezra's question yesterday. You know, this is exactly the example I was mentioning. But now, think about a submanifold in X. Now we can play the following game. Let's take O to be the cohomology of Y tensor n by n matrices. And again, it's the trace is the integral over Y. And the calculation I just described over here gives me pi of psi. It's the Euler character of Ty trace psi times 1 to the n. But now what I can do is I can define the closed to open transition by restricting phi to y to the submanifold and tensoring with the unit matrix. Okay, I'm sorry for the notation. This notation probably will drive some people crazy because this is the pullback of phi to y. Sorry about that. Nevertheless, you can now compute iota upper star. What is it doing? It's a map from the open string space, namely forms on y, to the closed string space, forms on x, so it obviously involves a tome class. Okay? And what you get is that iota upper star on psi is the pullback of the trace of psi to a small tubular neighborhood of y, wedge the compactly supported tome class in that neighborhood. So now if you compute iota upper star, iota lower star, you get the Euler character of the normal bundle times the trace of psi times 1. So these will agree. When will these agree? These will agree if the Euler characters of the normal bundle and tangent bundle are equal, and if theta naught squared is 1. So I think of theta naught as plus and minus 1 as changing the orientation of the brain, so that is compatible with my interpretation of brains and anti-brains as the choice of sine of the square root. And this is a little bit like the Lagrangian condition. And it's nice to note that the boundary state, iota upper star of 1, is simply n times the tome class. Now, I hope I haven't mucked this up. Graham tells me that, in fact, this example, well, I've produced some examples here. In fact, it's a very general class of Frobenius algebras because apparently by rational homotopy theory, I can identify a Z-graded rational Frobenius algebra as the rational cohomology algebra of some manifold with Poincaré duality. So in fact, while it might seem to you that this is a very special class of examples, it's a very general class of examples. If you have an integer grading on your Frobenius algebra, then there's some underlying manifold, and then you could run the story through.
But that wouldn't apply to functional algebra for all the others, not rational. You're there to underline ground, and either the complex numbers or some ring.
I see. Well, there are some tricky integrality conditions from the signature theorem. So that's a very good point. Okay. I'll need to think about that. What?
You want Z plus Z. I mean,
N. Oh, you mean I don't want negative degrees? Well, you're right. Okay. Okay. Let me just say one brief word about the B model. Now, it's clear that in some sense, the example I just gave was a modelish, because it involves this Euler character of the tangent space is the Euler character of the normal bundle. What about the B model? Well, you could simply start with the closed string sector that Paul explained this morning. So what did he say? He said that the closed string Frobenius algebra is the sum of zero P forms, D bar cohomology, with coefficients in lambda Q of the holomorphic tangent bundle. And the trace is to take a phi in here, to dot it into omega. See, it's a polyvector field, so you can dot that polyvector field into omega. That gives you a zero P form, which you can then wedge with omega, and you have a chance of getting something non-zero if P and Q are both equal to D, the complex dimension. Now, the whole point of Paul's lecture is that it's pretty difficult to say exactly what the category of boundary conditions should be. But if we just focus on holomorphic vector bundles, E1 and E2 on X, then we could certainly form these spaces. These are the analogs of OAB. And this is from Witten's 92 paper. So that is this cohomology here, the sum over zero P forms. Now, what I've got here is I'm imagining that these are Hermitian vector bundles with a unitary connection, and that unitary connection has a field strength such that F02 is 0. So it's only non-zero components or type 1-1. And the reason there's only one integer here is that the left and right moving n equals 2 currents are related to each other by the boundary condition. So whereas there are gradings P and Q for the left and right moving U1 currents in the closed case, in the open case, there's only a single one. And the trace is just the trace of psi wedge omega. So the interesting question is, what is iota lower star? And I think that iota lower star should be taking phi, which remember is a polyvector, and dotting it into the qth power of f. So in terms of indices, I've written out the indices right here. And that seems to satisfy all the conditions that you want. The Cardy condition becomes an interesting equation here, which I've written at the bottom here. And I still don't know exactly how, under what conditions that is or is not satisfied. So that concludes the topological field theories stories that I'm going to discuss. And tomorrow I will talk about some aspects of brains in the context of rational conformal field theory. And it will be very simple stuff. The idea is just to say, how do you get a picture of a brain given the description, the algebraic description, in terms of rational conformal field theory? In other words, what is the shape of a D brain that satisfies the Cardy condition? And so I'll say a few words about that. It's based on a work I did with Melda Chena and Zyberg. Thank you.